Hello and welcome to another episode of Midwest Magic. I am your host, Ethan Richardson, with my co-host,
Justin Washburn.
And we are joined by a very special guest today. You've heard us talking about him, making fun of him, you know, the normal things we do on the show. We are joined by the wonderful Mike Thompson. So, Mike, why don't you introduce yourself real quick to those who may not know you?
Hey, how's it going, folks? My name's Mike Thompson. Nothing special or fancy about me. I suppose you could call me an aspiring magic grinder is the title I would use, probably.
So, Mike, how long have you been playing magic?
I played for a long time. So when I was about 12 years old, I was given a bunch of Tempest cards, just nothing fancy, didn't buy them, just had a bunch of loose Tempest commons and uncommons given to me, and started playing with a buddy of mine, and I played probably until about my sophomore year of high school, so like 2002, and then I just stopped. Came back from college around 07, and got super into the game again, and I've been playing ever since. So I missed a lot of good stuff, but I also missed a lot of bad stuff too, so it's probably not horrible that I took a five or six year break in the middle. So, yeah.
Cool. And just for, again, those who don't know you, what are your favorite kinds of decks to play?
I think if I had to choose something that I wanted to play, it would be like a tempo style deck. So not necessarily blue, but it almost always ends up being blue. I think if other people said what type of player I was, I think they'd call me a dirty bear. So,
I think that's a fair assessment.
Yeah, whatever floats your boat, I guess.
All right. Well, we've been out of it a few weeks here, just been busy with life and stuff. And honestly, I don't know about you guys, but I haven't really had the opportunity to play much Magic lately overall since we got back from Kansas City, really.
I've not played much actual Standard or Modern. I've played a butt ton of EDH, though. We started an EDH league in town, and so we've been playing a lot of that. So
I play against the famous Josh Harry this week.
I don't think Josh Harry's famous.
He's definitely not, but I mean, he is now, I guess. We've said his name on the internet.
We love him anyway. All right, so let's go ahead and get right into things. We had some, you know, fairly local representation do pretty well over at SCG Denver this weekend, which was Standard. So we're going to go into that quick, and I think we'll talk a little bit about Modern since we have Mike here, who I know both Justin and Mike tend to gravitate Modern a little more than I do, but thought it'd be interesting to talk about that. And then the TCG player 50K, which is why I might move the order. So first we'll go into SCG Denver, with the first place deck being Esper Tokens. Now, I was actually not expecting that. Like, I knew Esper Tokens is a pretty good deck, but I didn't think it was, like, winning everything good. So, and I don't think we've talked much about the lists, so, Mike, since you're the guest, I will give you the first run of the lists if you would like to go through this one.
Oh, absolutely. I actually really, really like this list. I watched him play against Todd Anderson a couple times over the weekend, so I was very, very interested in this list. So yeah, let me get through it. It's piloted by Vikram Kubla, who I believe is from the Ohio area. He's a PTQ grinder from that area, been playing Magic for a long, long time. But the deck list is 4 Monastery Mentor, 4 Seeker of the Way, 2 Dragonlord Ojutai, 4 Jace Friends Prodigy, 4 Gideon Ally of Zendikar, 1 Obnixilus Reignited, 1 Soren Solemn Visitor, a bunch of lands that you probably don't want me to go through, 4 Soap Wraps, 2 Murderous Cut, a single Ultimate Price, a single Utter End, a Ruinous Path, 2 Treasure Cruises, and 4 Mainboard Duress. Yeah. it was a pretty interesting... Oh, I guess I should give you the sideboard, too. I'm sorry. 2 Stratus Dancer, 1 Mastery of the Unseen, 2 Disdainful Stroke, a Dispel, 2 Search of Righteousness, 1 Ultimate Price, 2 Infinite Obliteration, 1 Languish, 1 Planar Outburst, and 2 Self-Inflicted.
Oh, man. I haven't had the chance to play against this deck, and I am definitely not playing it right now. But, I mean, is it really just as simple, pretty much, as, you know, just getting your mentors out and doing stupid things with also your Gideons?
So my take on the deck so far has been, like, this is not what the Esper Tokens list of this format has looked like, really, to this point. Before it was running a lot of secure the waste and actual token generators, and this one seems to rely more on just good value 2 and 3 drop Secure the Way and Monastery Mentor, which are both very good against the aggro matchup, and they're just good beat sticks that get value whenever you cast your awesome spells. So it's more of like a black-white beatdown deck that splashes for Ojutai and Jace, just to be completely honest, but it's a solid-looking list, it really is.
Yeah, and I was just thinking about that, like with the Monastery Mentor and your Seeker, the way you obviously want to get those prowess from the token triggers, and then when you add Jace to the mix, so you're recasting all your crap all the time, that just seems a little ridiculous.
Yeah, and it does seem like it matches up pretty well against Jeskai Black, which is obviously still one of the most popular decks in the format. The four duresses really kind of make the removal in that deck a lot less impactful. Game one, they're really only playing the dooms and an ultimate price maybe as far as Fiery Impulse. I'm sorry, that's the card I missed. But when you're just generating extra creatures, it's not really all that bad when your Monastery Mentor dies or your Seeker of the Way dies or something like that. So you're just generating value with every card in the deck. It's one of those. You can try and one for one me, but I'm gonna beat you. Like, if that's your game plan, you can't keep up.
What do you think, Justin?
Treasure Cruise making a return, and I like it.
Yeah, that was one thing I did kind of hear from other, people talking about it, is just how prevalent Treasure Cruise was at the whole tournament in general. And I think that, it's one of those decks or one of those cards that I think everyone overvalued Dig Through Time in Standard and didn't value Treasure Cruise enough, because they do very different things when you really, dissect it.
Yeah, absolutely. And there were, like you mentioned, it was very popular at the event. There were a lot of decks, like Todd Anderson, I believe, just completely, I could be wrong, but it just wasn't playing Dig Through Time. It was playing Treasure Cruise instead, which is not normal in a Jeskai Black deck. So, I mean...
Yeah, it's just situations of, do you want card selection? Do you want to essentially scry 7 and draw 2? Or do you just want to draw 3 and you're going to be able to cast whatever it is? And I think in Jeskai Black, that's actually probably pretty easy to just cast whatever you draw off the Treasure Cruise and have it be worth something.
Yeah, absolutely true. And I think another thing that's a little telling about the way the format worked this week was, and this is jumping ahead a little bit, but Tom Ross playing Atarka Red, and he's been on like pretty hard on Green-White Megamorph this season. And him going to mono red kind of signals to me that he had a feeling that we were going to kind of start going back to this more sorcery speed format where Silk Grab is really good and cards like, Silk Grab and Ruinous Path get slightly better, and cards like Murderous Cut and Ultimate Price are disappearing a little bit. They're still around, just in much smaller numbers. And I think that's obviously a great time to be playing mono red.
Yeah, which actually leads directly into second place, which was Atarka Red. And I won't spend too much time on this list because it's pretty, straightforward, mostly stuff we've seen before. But it is kind of interesting. It is running the 4 McKindy Slide Runner rather than more Lightning Berserkers or another Zergo, and I can't quite tell what else they might have taken out for it, just looking through it quick. But the thing we haven't been seeing, I think, as much as maybe we should be, is the 2 Hooting Mandrills in the sideboard. Like, I think people just don't realize how crazy that card is, because if you can get a 4/4 trample for 1, that just seems good.
Yeah, and especially when you're like Titan Strength it or become immense it, it's just...
Well, that's actually the thing about it, is you're probably not going to be embiggening your Hooting Mandrills anytime soon.
Yeah, it's so weird. I think it's definitely a good idea. Like, they're obviously playing it to beat the more aggressive decks that are kind of mirror-esque. So, like, the Megamorph decks and the other Atarka Red decks and stuff like that, the Landfall decks, things along those lines. But I think it's an interesting way to go. The card's been kind of overshadowed by the other Delve cards that immediately saw play, like Murderous Cut, Dig Through Time, and Treasure Cruise, obviously. But it's an insanely good card on its own. Anytime you can have a 4/4 for a discount, even if the card shows as 6 mana, anytime you can get a 4/4 for a discount is super good.
Yeah, and the trample just adds to that. And then it's also got Pia and Kieran Nalar in the sideboard, which has not seen as much standard play lately, but is also working its way into modern, which we'll probably see when we look at the modern list a little bit later. So I just think it's kind of some interesting sideboard choices, and I think that the, I haven't quite figured out how I feel about McKinney Slide Runner yet, just because, the trample's really nice, so you don't have to worry about having that Teamer Battle Rage every time you get the slide run on the field, but when you're running 21 lands, the landfall is just less relevant. Not irrelevant, just not as relevant. But I think it's, like you were saying earlier, Mike, it is just kind of an interesting choice, for the way the metagame is shifting again.
Absolutely, absolutely. But it gives it almost gives you that over the top, like, if you only draw one piece of the combo, so you just draw Become Immense, but you have a Slide Runner in play, you play your land, you fetch your land, and now you still have a Teamer Battle Rage-esque or Teamer Battle Rage-like creature because you get that pump and you have trample. Obviously, you don't get the double strike, but...
But you're still hitting for a ton, so...
Yeah, exactly.
One deck I heard some people pretty excited about, I didn't get to see it played, unfortunately, is the 5-color Bring to Light, which we haven't seen in a while. So, Justin, why don't you take us through that list?
It was piloted by Joe Lissette. He was playing 3 Den Protector, 4 Siege Rhino, 4 Jace Friends Prodigy, 2 Nissa Vastwood Seer, and then 26 assortment of Fetchland, Battleland-esque mana base. He's also running 4 Obzon Charm, 2 Complete Disregard, 1 Crackling Doom, 2 Dispel, 1 Colligan's Command, 1 Silumgar's Command, 2 Utter End, 3 Bring to Light, 2 Languish, and 3 Treasure Cruise. And his sideboard consists of 2 Negate, 4 Surge of Righteousness, 1 Anathema of the Foremost, 2 Infinite Obliteration, 3 Painful Truth, and 3 Radiant Flame.
So is this deck literally just Bring to Value?
Oh yeah, I played it... at Tuesday Night Magic, I didn't win a single round, but it was just like, I can bring to light for anything. This is actually kind of awesome. And being able to, like, feed your graveyard to treasure cruises is just such a good feeling. Like, draw 3 cards for 1 blue is pretty insane.
Was Treasure Cruise played in any of the previous versions of the Bring to Light deck?
I would have no clue.
So I played an exact 75 of the Jerry Thompson list, the one that won the very first open after Battle for Zendikar came out. I played that for probably a month, and it was a lot of fun. But his was a lot more or less toolboxy, like this one is. Like, the 1-0s and 2-0s in this deck, it's very obvious that he's... They're always good when you draw them, and Bring to Light for any of them is just very good value. Jerry was playing, I believe... In that original list, he was playing the new 2 blue and 3 that says Scry X. Scry X and then draw cards equal to your... Or draw Scry 3, excuse me. Scry 3 and draw X equal to your highest converted mana cost, which worked well because you could bring to light for it, but I think Treasure Cruise is just flat out better. Like, it, no question.
Yeah.
Yeah, you can't bring the light, but, you know, like Justin said, drawing 3 cards for a blue... is pretty
exactly.
good.
Exactly.
Is Anafenza in the sideboard just for the rally decks?
Absolutely.
Yeah,
no question. I think it's also reasonable for them to bring in Infinite Obliteration against those decks.
Definitely.
It's kind of weird, but one of the things you can do is, like, if you have an Infinite Obliteration in your hand or something like that, you can, or an Anafenza in your hand, you can just play the Anafenza or bring to light for Anafenza, and then when they try to go off, you just, at the end of that turn, cast Infinite Obliteration for all the cards they have in their graveyard or something like that. So
Infinite Obliteration's a sorcery.
No, that's what I mean. After they do all their
gotcha,
stack to put the cards in the graveyard so that they don't die to Anafenza, you can just Infinite Obliteration after they do all that stuff. Now, obviously, you're not going to catch a great player doing that, and sometimes you're just going to have to do one for a little bit less value. But Infinite Obliteration naming Zul'Porn Cutthroat almost just shuts the deck off.
Yeah, they can play all the creatures they want. And
exactly.
They're
going
to have a hell of a time getting there after that.
They're playing a fair game.
It's just bad beats. Like, their deck just turns into, like,
Name
just a bunch of dudes that are going to try to beat you down.
Exactly.
It's like when you resolve a Stony Silence against Affinity. You're just playing a really bad beat stack, but they might kill you.
So does... I guess with 26 lands, Nissa flips pretty easily in the deck, and Planeswalker side of Nissa is kind of good. Just kind of good. And then Jace, always good. Seed Rhino is value town. And then I like, you know, of course, Den Protector and get back your Bring to Lights to tutor more. I think it's an interesting deck. If I had a couple of the cards I'd be missing for this, it would definitely be something I would consider sleeving up, because I think it's the most, you know, it's been a while since Standard has had a toolboxy, you know, just search for all your answers kind of thing, so.
Yeah.
I think it's cool. Alright, so fourth place was, Jeskai Black, Mantis Rider version. This one's, I mean, it's a little bit different. It's got most of the same stuff. Two Duress main board, running only two Ogitize Command, running one Anticipate, two Monastery Mentors, three Seeker of the Ways. So, honestly, this one seems like it's a little more aggressive than most Jeskai Blacklists.
Yeah, the biggest change I see is the two Monastery Mentors and the three Seeker of the Ways replacing, almost universally played Soulfire Grandmaster and one of Dragon Master Outcasts. So it's a little bit different than a lot of lists have looked. It's also playing a Valor Stance and an extra Fire Impulse, which is, I mean, those make obvious sense, but it is definitely a little bit different. And I think that's probably why it plays slightly higher, because when you're not expecting cards, they can obviously blow you out a lot easier. But.
All right, and so without looking, can anyone tell me what the card Fate Forgotten does?
Fate Forgotten.
Don't look at it.
Exile target artifact or enchantment for a white and a colorless?
Two colorless.
I think it costs three, yeah. I knew it exiled something, it costs three, but past that.
Okay, it's instant. Okay, yeah.
Yeah, I'm going to be honest, and I do not remember this card at all. So it's first time I've seen it in any board ever, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah.
But it's running one in the sideboard. I mean, what do you bring that in against that, you know, what would you want this over something like Silk Wrap for?
Honestly, I'm not entirely sure. I do know, the thing that just pops to mind for me is he's not playing any Silk Wraps at all. So without the buyback value that you can get with Soulfire Grandmaster, something he might want to be doing is, like, if his first Jace gets Silk Wrapped or something like that, and he never has a chance to find a second one, Fate Forgotten can be really good on your opponent's end step, blow up your Silk Wrap and get back my dude. But outside of that, the only card I can think of that even is played fairly often that would do something is maybe an opponent's Virulent Plague if they see Monastery Mentor game one, or if a red deck tries to go big and plays Outpost Siege. Those are about the only ones I can think of off the top of my head.
Yeah, and see, like, I'm trying to think in the realm of artifacts, of what artifacts are getting played to the point where this would be necessary over even, like, Erase.
I mean, there's Hedron Archive, like, you just slow down the Eldrazi opponent, like, maybe one or two turns. But he's also not playing any Infinite Obliteration. So yeah,
I suppose you could use it, and now I just totally forgot what card I was thinking about. You said Infinite Obliteration, my mind just went.
So excited.
Yeah, I am. Hangar Mech Walker. If you're anticipating a bunch of people, like we were talking about, the format slowing down, going back to a sorcery speed format a little bit, Fate Forgotten's a really good answer to Hangar Mech Walker that is not Crackling Doom. So there is that, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, I just think it's some interesting choices, and, you know, nobody's expecting to see that card show up at all. So
yeah, you get this card cast on you, and you're like, wait, what does it do? And they go, artifact or enchantment. Huh. Yeah, that's pretty good.
I'm willing to bet it got read a couple times over the weekend.
Well, and not even that, but are you ever playing a game of Magic and then someone casts a card, you don't know what it does, and they explain it to you, but you still don't process it, so then it resolves and it all happens, and then you're like, oh, wait, no, I could have answered that?
Yep.
I have a feeling that happened at least once.
Oh, absolutely.
Some
absolutely.
Guy's like, yeah, sure, whatever, and then it happens, and he's like, oh, God, no, I had a counterspell, but I had to read that card, so I forgot.
Absolutely.
All right, anyway, okay, so at fifth place is the true, like, heroic story of the entire event. It was Logan Mize went, like, a million rounds undefeated, and then, made the top eight, ends in fifth place. The first Abzan list in the whole top eight, you know, as we're going down. I mean, I don't see anything out of the ordinary for it. It seems pretty, you know, Abzan aggro that we're used to, running the Heir of the Wilds in that two-drop slot, along with Den Protector.
Can we talk about the sideboard madness going on?
Yeah. The sideboard is where it's at, dude.
Yes.
The sideboard is where it's at.
He's playing a four pitless hordes? What?
Yeah, Pitiless Horde is...
Oh, my lord.
So they were actually talking about this on... Seti and Pisoli were talking about it, and they questioned it. And if you think about it, if they're just trying to beat control decks, this card is insane.
Oh, yeah.
Nuts.
You just keep boxing it in.
And four turns. Four turns. And you've probably already dealt a whole bunch of damage at that point. Like, they languish you on turn four, you untap and hit them for five, and they're already at, like, 9 or 10 life. Like, that's insanely good. And then if you dash it again and they happen to counter it, you just, okay, well, now I'll just go back to this other game that I was playing before, and now you have to have another board left. It's just, it's a super valuable card.
I mean, sometimes it wouldn't even be bad to put in, like, one or two. I mean, it's still a good three drop. Like, if you don't have an Anafenza on turn three, you need to keep applying pressure.
Yeah, but is the losing two life worth it?
Oh yeah, definitely.
I think that's the big kicker on a card like this. In the matchups where, like, say against mono red, where you're just playing creature after creature after creature, and you want to have an extra creature to pressure them so that they can't just combo kill you, this is the type of, like, this is the slot that you want to have that creature in, but you don't have it anymore because this creature, like, you can't bring this in the red matchup. There's no way.
Well, and it just dies to Fiery Impulse.
True. Very, very true.
And which just, you know, is just one of those other checks in the cons list. But yeah, I think that, I mean, I didn't get to watch much of Logan Mize play, but did this Pitiless Horde really make that much of it? Like, was that the card that made him undefeated, or is Abzan just that good in general?
I didn't watch any Esper control matchups where Logan Mize, like, played this card and Twitch chat just went AWOL. They're like, what the hell's happening? But I don't know. I'd have to test it out for myself. This Pitiless Horde is four sideboard slots.
You know, the biggest thing I noticed, and this is, I don't play Abzan, so part of it is probably just that I'm not familiar with the evolution of the deck. But it seems like a much bigger version. Like, this is the closest to an Abzan control deck that we've had. Yes, it's still playing Warden, it's still playing Heir to the Wilds, but it's trying to do the beatdown game while stopping your opponent from doing the same thing, which is, in my opinion, geared toward the metagame. A lot of the Jeskai decks are going to a more controlling shell and cutting Mantis Riders, Todd Anderson especially. He's been advocating that for the last couple weeks. So you see a lot of more like tempo control decks. They're not actually control decks, but they're not really aggressive decks either. So it's interesting to see a full four Anafenza again. A lot of them have been cutting down to two and three of those. And they're trimming on Jamoka's Commands again as well. So I know that card is not fantastic right now, but it's still one of the most powerful green-white cards that people can play right now. So it's interesting to see them trim a couple of those.
Yeah, I just picked up, finally, my fourth Grimoka today, actually. So. So that leads us pretty well, then, into sixth place, which was Todd Anderson, playing Jeskai Black. He has been an advocate of the Mantis Rider free version, focusing on Dragon Master Outcast and Soulfire Grandmasters for much of his win condition. I mean, is Jeskai Black still where you want to be in this format? Like, is it still strong enough to stand up to the other decks that are preying on it? Can it adapt? You know, where do we think Jeskai Black is going to keep going before the next set comes out, essentially?
Well, it's hard to tell, really, because we're so close to the next set coming up, and we haven't seen any of the cards yet. Like, we're in that weird, awkward 2-week period right before spoilers start, where they've given us a couple cards that are probably going to be, like, big highlight cards, big flashy cards for the set, but might not ever see standard play. And none of them really fit in. One of them obviously can't because it's red-green, but none of them really fit into what Jeskai Black is trying to do. Now, having said that, the white-black core, legendary core, is a super cool-looking card, and you could absolutely put it in a deck like this because you're using the Black Splash. But I think the biggest thing for Jeskai is that it just has the answer. And it is, like, yes, there are Esper Dragons decks in the format, but those decks are more like traditional control, where they just answer you one for one because all of their removal slash counter spells are hard answers for everything. Whereas this deck kind of has to evolve with the metagame. You need to change your cards based on what people are playing. If you look at the list, Todd has 2 Roasts in the deck and 2 Painful Truths. And those are cards that say to me, okay, we can't just win with Mantis Rider Beats or just with Jace Value, so we're going to play some other cards that are in that one-for-one control type of game, but get us just a little bit further ahead. We're not going to be an actual control deck because we can't just one for everything, but we can do that a little bit and get value where we can.
All right, Mike, I haven't had a chance to discuss this with you yet, so I want to pose a question here.
All right.
Painful Truths, great draw engine or the greatest?
The greatest? That might be, I mean, we do have a card that got printed called Ancestral Recall, so, but in Standard, I think it's the best draw card in Standard. I mean, if we're being just completely honest, I've seen it played in Standard, I've seen it see a little bit of play in Modern, and I believe, I could be wrong about this, but I believe Patrick Chapin, Matt Sperling, the guys on that team, played an Esper, like, tempo deck at the Legacy Grand Prix that was playing Painful Truths, and there are some sick things that can come up in Legacy and Modern with Painful Truths. Like, if there's a Thalia in play, for instance, and I cast Painful Truths for 4 mana, if I cast it with 4 colors of mana, I lose 4 life and draw 4 cards.
Yep.
Like, that's not actually a penalty with this card. So any card like that, I mean, it's kind of a drawback because you're still paying extra mana for the card, but any card like that that can see play in older formats, it's worth taking a second look at. I know a lot of people looked at this card and went, nah, it's crap. We're not going to play it. It's not worth the time. But the more I look at it, the more I hear people playing with the card. LSV's been talking about this card since day one, and that should have been a freaking light bulb to me. But
yeah. Well, I think it's crazy to be able to put Painful Truths and Treasure Cruise in the same deck.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Can you imagine drawing 6 cards on one turn for 4 mana?
I want you to stop talking dirty to me right now.
It's doable, man.
Ahead, Justin.
One of the other cool things is with Soulfire Grandmaster and Roast, you can roast their dude. Like, if you have 5 mana and you have a Soulfire, you roast their dude, you gain 5 life, and then you pay 3 life to draw 3 cards.
So
you got 2 life, and then you're probably swinging if they have no board. And so you just gained 4 life, essentially, and drew 3 cards in one turn.
Yeah, and
it's just insane.
Yeah, not to like jump around topics or anything, but that goes back to what I was talking about with the way the game plan has changed a little bit. We're not just going to beat you down with 3-3 flyers and hope that that's good enough when we are flashing back Jace's to remove spells or flashing back our Dig Through Time to find more removal and stuff like that. We're not on the just one-for-one game. There are going to be games where we just go turn 2 Jace, turn 2 Soulfire Grandmaster, and then we one-for-one value until we kill you with our 2 creatures. Like, there are going to be games that happen like that. So it's hard to put it into a category because it's not really a control deck. It's not really a tempo deck. You can call it tempo control, but it's not. It's more of a mixture of the two than calling it a control deck that has creatures in it. So it's in that weird kind of in-between space, like Abzan Control was last season.
Yeah, Abzan Control's all over the place. So, yeah, Jeskai Black is still strong, still doing well. The next deck is 4-Color Rally in 7th place. I'm not going to spend too much time on this one because this has shown up pretty much every podcast we've done since Battle for Zendikar came out. But this version is running 1 Liliana Heretical Healer in the main board, which hasn't been done as much lately. In the initial versions of the Rally decks, she was a pretty big engine throughout the whole deck, but it's just gone down to one, because, I mean, the deck just got to the point where it's so four of everything, you're just so consistent that, you know, throwing the Liliana in there just threw you off, but I think, you know, having one is definitely awesome. It's just an awesome card. And then another in the side. And then here's the interesting thing, is they're now running an Offenza in the sideboard for the mirror match.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
Oh, yeah.
Like,
that was
so good.
Go ahead, Mike.
That was, I mean, it was talked about a lot. I know when we went to Kansas City, Nick talked about playing a playset of Offenzas in his sideboard and then decided to just play two because it's just, it's not good in anything else. Like, you can't side it in against the Abzan decks because you're already pretty good in that matchup and it doesn't really do anything. It's only good against this one deck, and you can't really play Hollow Moonlight because it shuts you off at the same time, and sometimes while you're interacting, you want to go off while they're doing it. So it's a weird card to see, but it actually makes a lot of sense. And I'm surprised we didn't see it sooner.
Yeah, well, and I just sit here and think about the first time the Rally deck showed up in Origin stand and how much the deck has changed, how, you know, at that point, it was like five-color Rally the Ancestors, and you didn't have the ally triggers, and you didn't have the Zulaport cutthroats, but and you had what? The other black dude from Theros that gave everything Intimidate. Just how much the deck has changed, and how when that deck first came out, everyone's like, oh, that's neat. How, you know, good luck with that. Have fun. And now we're here.
You know, I think, and this is not to like spit in your face or anything. It's kind of turned, it's gotten more tools that allow it to play like a controlling game. Like, they can use City Seize Faithful to keep your creatures out of play, so they can just get in incremental damage until the turn they go off. Obviously it picked up Elvish Visionary, and Nantico Husk and Origins with Catacomb Sifter and Battle for Zendikar. So like, it has gotten a lot of cards. Personally, I think the older version was better. I really do. I just think that format was harder to beat it in. Like, all of the Abzan decks were just playing four of Anofenzas. And at the time, they didn't have a way to get Anofenza out of play. It just sat in play, and the only way you could kill it was with removal spells, and when you're only playing two or three, it doesn't really work, but Mogus Marauder was insane in that deck.
Yeah.
And it's a little harder to just flat out kill your opponent, but at the same time, now you have the I never need to attack you win condition, where I just sack a bunch of dudes to Nantico Husk, sack Nantico Husk, rally, and then do it again and kill you. So, it's in my opinion, it's still the same deck. It just, instead of giving all of its students Intimidate to kill you, it just can interact without having to do normal things. And in the history of Magic, anytime a deck can win without having to interact the way other decks are interacting in the format, it's just super.
Justin, what's your take?
I think the deck's neat. I don't know. I think it would take a lot of, I think it would take a lot of practice to get this deck down to a Scion. Like, I feel like on the outside, you can just look at it and you're like, yeah, I can play this deck. But then when you sleeve it up and play it, you're just like, I don't know how to exactly do this. How do I get out of this situation?
And, you know, that's really interesting because, like, my wife built, or she had the event deck, and we just kind of upgraded a bit. We threw in a couple Lilianas, rounded out some play sets, took out some of the lesser cards. And, I mean, that one's only black-green. That's only two colors, and I don't have half the triggers and half the creatures that are in the four-color version. I can't imagine having to make sure you fetch the right lands and then, you know, worry about all your triggers coming in and remembering them every time and, you know, all of that stuff. I can't even, ugh.
Oh, yeah.
I also like the Obzon Ascendancies in the sideboard. Like, ever since the black-green event deck came out, I'm like, oh, if you just splash white for Obzon Ascendancy, this deck seems a lot better.
Yeah, that's like Justin's favorite card.
I want to play it, but I'm on the right shell.
At least it's the same play.
Might as well just play Obzon aggro in the sideboard and just be like, oh, I played this card, I'm going to beat you with one ones.
See,
it's
my
not, it's,
go ahead.
It's a good card. It's a very good card just to beat control strategies. You just Abzan Ascendancy, and then they have to answer that before they wipe your board.
And see, my favorite card was Mardu Ascendancy, so, I mean...
Why not both?
Look where I am.
Okay, Los Dos.
Alright, let's finish off this SCG here. Eighth place was Atarka Red, Tom Ross. Again, it's the more, you know, classic version with the Hordling Outburst. The one interesting thing was Goblin Heel Cutter in the main board as a one of, and a Vault Breaker in the sideboard. Now, I'm going to read this card, because I don't think people think of Vault Breaker very often when they think of Target Red. So Vault Breaker is three colorless and one red. Whenever Vault Breaker attacks, you may discard a card. If you do, draw a card. You can dash him for two and a red, and he's a 4/2.
Yeah, it's a couple things, to be completely honest. So in a lot of matchups, it's just going to be a beat stick. But in my opinion, the decks that you bring it in against are just control decks. Like it looks to me like you cut a bunch of the token makers because you feel like your opponent's going to bring in stuff to kill that. Like the violent, I don't know what that card is. Two in the black tokens get -2/-2. So you cut some of your token makers. You bring in Vault Breaker, Den Protectors, and Chandra's, and you just value them out. They're going to use all of their removal to kill your stuff. They're probably going to do it at instant speed, so there's a very good chance Vault Breaker's limit ends up dying, but you also are giving them another instant speed threat. Like, a lot of your creatures don't just have haste flat out, so having another creature that you can just cheat into play for cheap, it does something relevant in the matchup, and then it allows them to... So say you're attacking with two Lightning Berserkers and a Vault Breaker, or a Monastery Swisper, a Lightning Berserker, and a Vault Breaker. They have to choose at that point whether they want you to draw a card or whether they want to kill your Vault Breaker and maybe die to the combo. So it gives you... It's weird that it's only one card, but it kind of gives you a second angle.
Okay, so here's the one thing I kind of like about it is... Yeah, you know, the trigger, whenever it attacks, you may discard a card. If you do, draw a card. With Atarka Red, you occasionally have those hands where you have, like, two teamer Battle Rage and nothing else. So this even gives you a filter for that. You know, you can discard the, you know, second teamer Battle Rage, and whatever you draw is probably going to be better than that.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I just think that's kind of an interesting take that, you know, a lot of people have been trying to figure out the best way to give Atarka Red some card advantage. You know, whether it's playing Outpost Siege in the sideboards for the slower map, or, you know, whatever, Abbots of Carol Keep, of course. But, you know, there's just so little the deck can do after you've dumped your hand, whether you needed to or just trying to get there quicker. The deck needs something to refuel, and I think this is an interesting way to do that. I don't know if it's the best.
Yeah, I think seeing a couple more of these would not surprise me. Like you mentioned, it lets you pitch your extra cards, whether it be you land or a token generator after they've played hate cards or something like that. So it gives you almost a third dimension, because you're a beatdown deck playing a combo kill, and now you have this card advantage. So I wouldn't be surprised at all to see a couple more cards. Think of it as like a red Murkluder almost.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, it doesn't even have to connect. It just, when it attacks. So I think that's a big plus a big check mark in the plus category, definitely.
Very good. Okay, so that's the top eight. I don't know if you guys wanted to look through the other lists to see if there's anything in particular you wanted to talk about. There's a black-red aggro list at 12th, which looks pretty interesting. I do recommend listeners give that one a look. The link to the decks will be in the show notes. A couple of Atarka Reds at 15th and 16th. Did you guys have any?
No, just wanted to give a quick shout-out to Caleb Scherer and Nick Carlson. Caleb's been on a tear lately. He, I believe, won or got second place at the Legacy Open last weekend, was it? And then he's 10th place here. He's another one of those guys in the race to make the Players' Championship, and he's not a name a lot of people know. So super good Magic player. When he's in his comfort zone, he can play lights out, and he plays Legacy Tendrils, so he's he gets a thumbs up from me. And Nick Carlson in 11th place. Local guy, he's from Kearney, Nebraska. He's always been a great Magic player, but he's kind of been on a tear lately. He's one of those guys that you expect at some point to make the break to the Pro Tour. And he's, I think he's like 19 or 20 years old, super young kid. Very, very good at Magic. He deserves all the praise he gets. Probably shouldn't give him too much. It might make his head a little big, but he absolutely deserves it.
If he listens to this, I don't think we'll hear the end of it. So good job, local. Matt Carlson was there also. I don't know how he did.
I believe he made day two and did okay, but outside of that, I have no real clue.
Right, okay. Justin, any decks you wanted to go over?
Well, on the very last page, Gary Thompson at 116th place playing Mardu Dream. He did a premium article on this deck, and it kind of made me want to play the deck. Like, it's basically just a Mardu shell splashing green for Obzon Charms, Dim Protectors, and Seed Rhinos.
Oh, good lord. And, I mean, the only other board creature is the Soulfire Grandmaster.
Yeah, and then he's playing, like, main board, two Roast, and then two Painful Troops.
Call Against Command.
His sideboard is playing a Dark Petition, which is really good, because if you have Spell Mastery, you can Dark Petition for an Infinite Obliteration and play them both in the same turn.
Good lord.
So that's an interaction that kind of tickled my fancy. I was like, when I went through this deck, I was like, Dark Petition, and I read it, and then I looked down below an Infinite Obliteration, I'm like, oh, okay, I see what this is doing.
Oh, that's disgusting.
I just like that little... Or you could get the Virulent Plague too and play that in the same turn. Like, there's just so
lies.
Many
lies.
Read the bones.
I'm just kidding. I'm sorry.
Yeah, Read the Bones making a comeback.
Read the Bones is a good card.
This
really
is disgusting. This is a disgusting list. Why would you make me look at?
Well, here's the thing though. It just plays all the best cards in Standard and then splashes a color. Like, that's that's how the format works right now. You either play a dedicated style of deck, or you just play the best cards and splash whatever color you can.
I've seen a lot of people complaining about Standard lately. I kind of like that approach to Standard, but that's just me who has a good majority of Standard staples already in my binder.
People are always going to complain about Standard.
Yeah,
It's just the nature of the beast. They will always complain about it. It's never good enough when it's good, and when it's bad... We remember how good the last one was, even though we called it terrible at the time.
Yeah. I've been on a kick about Magic players lately, but we can get into that later. I think we should talk a little bit about Modern, which, as an aggro player myself, it always makes me happy to see Burn in first place. So, let's see here. Chris Anderson, piloted Burn. It seems pretty stock for this part. Goblin Guides, Lavamancer, Swift Spears, Eidolons, some lands, Atarkus Commands, Boros Charm, Lightning Bolt, Searing Blaze, Skullcrack, Lava Spike, Rift Bolt, Sideboard, Core Firewalkers, Deflecting Palms, which I don't see as often as I think I should, Destructive Ovary, Lightning Helix, Path, that's not normal, I don't think, 2 Rending Volley and 2 more Skullcrack, it's a pretty, like... That's a pretty concise burn list, even.
Yeah, so the Naya Burn deck, which this is not, let me clarify, but the Naya Burn deck has been playing a lot of... It's basically like a one-drop zoo deck, and I prefer that list a little bit. It gives you a little bit more flexibility with your spells, but obviously it's not as flat-out powerful as this deck is when it's running on all cylinders.
Which is all the time.
Well, true. That is absolutely true. The only thing that's really different that I see, and admittedly I haven't played Burn in Modern for a long, long time, but the only thing that's a little bit weird is seeing a Lightning Helix pop up again. For a long time it was just played as a 3 of in the deck, and after Atarkus Command came out, it just disappeared completely. Which makes sense, obviously, but it's interesting to see one of those again. I wonder what it's for, to be completely honest. Probably the mirror, but that gives you, what, 6 cards to sign in the mirror? Firewalkers, Palms, 7 cards. Firewalkers, Palms, Helix, and Pass. So, I mean, Modern is kind of turning into a creature-based format again, whereas, I mean, it's always been a creature-based format because there's no control deck, but it's getting more that way. We're seeing a lot of decks that their main win condition is beat down. and it hasn't been that way for a while, so it's nice to see a little bit of variation in sideboard and deck construction and stuff like that, even in a burn deck.
Yeah, and I mean, at least we no longer have the days of burn splashing blue for treasure crews.
Yeah, that was pretty miserable. Dare you, Shaheen Serrani, making people want to play that deck.
Alright, second place was Affinity. I don't know much about Affinity at all, so I don't really know if there's anything weird about this level. I don't think so.
Playing Welding Jar is a one of, which isn't that bad.
Welding
Jar has actually seen a fair uptick in play with the burn decks gaining popularity again. Welding Jar is a zero cost artifact that just says sacrifice Welding Jar, regenerate an artifact. So basically, you just use it to save whatever your edition is.
That seems really good.
Yeah, it's real good. It basically says counter your destroy target artifact spell. So
bye bye Kolaghan's Command.
Yeah, when your opponent Kolaghan's commands your creature and your cranial plating, you just go, okay, save the cranial plating. Kill you, basically.
Yeah.
The only thing I see in the list that's a little weird are the Grafdigger's Cage and the Relic of Progenitus. Obviously, those are in the sideboard, but I think that's kind of a nod to people being legitimately terrified about the Grishol brand deck. Relic of Progenitus can be the instant speed, although it's not very easy in an Affinity deck, and Grafdigger's Cage just says no.
Do Affinity decks normally play Blood Moon in the sideboard?
Oh, yeah. Well, it depends if they're, like, the red-based Affinity or the blue-based. But
yep.
Red-based is more popular, I think. But as far as I can tell, every Affinity player I've ever played, they always bring in Blood Moon, but they never see it. Hmm. But sometimes Blood Moon just gets there.
Interesting. I didn't know that. Okay, third place was Abzan Collected Company. Justin, why don't you tell me all about that?
It's a little bit... It's different than... it's got a few one-ofs from the Malira stock list. We'll just run through it real quick. Playing one Spellskite, four Birds of Paradise, one Blood Artist, one Catacomb Sifter, four Eternal Witness, four Kitchen Prince, three Noble Hierarch, one Kosali Pride Mage, one Scavenging Muse, two Viserys Seer, three Voice of Resurgence, one Courser of Kruthic, three Anafins of Kinfry Spirit, and one Varal's the Starstrike.
spicy.
Yeah, spicy. Bells, one Abrupt Decay, three Court of Calling, four Collected Company, and one Path to Exile. And then his sideboard consists of one Spellskite, one Tide Hollow Scholar, two Burrington Forge Tender, two Fulminator Mage, one Kosali Pride Mage, one Scavenging Ooze, one more Courser of Prefix, two Path to Exile, two Kataki Wars Wage, and two Thoughtseize. So it's got some spicy meatballs.
Oh, yeah. Yes, it does.
Like, Blood Artist creates this effect where they don't even have, like, they're not even playing Murderous Red Cap. It's just, I'm going to sack my Kitchen Finks to my Viserys here, trigger Blood Artist. Oh, bring it back into play. And offensive entry triggers, okay. I put a counter on it. Yeah, it just negates the counter, and then you just Blood Artist them out of the game. Like, you know, that's basically your win con.
The most interesting thing to me in this list, now, I know Malira isn't as popular in Collected Company decks as it was in Birthing Pod, but the most interesting thing to me is that there is literally zero copies of Malira Sirlock Outcast.
Yeah, and I was playing two in my list, just because if they got rid of a Malira from, like, discard or whatever, and then they surgical extract it, or an Anafenza, I'm like, well, I can't combo kill you now. And you just have to play Kitchen Prince, Eternal Witness, Beat Deck, with Gavinny. That's basically how you kill your opponent from them. So if you have Anafenza and Malira, you know, they have to get both of them to shut you off completely the combo.
So is Catacomb Sifter even worth running in this deck?
I don't know. It seems decent.
I mean,
the Scry is relevant.
It's being pretty much used as a pseudo other Viserys Seer.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think part of it is, like, with the Catacomb Sifter and Varals in the deck, Varals just gives you a sack outlet. Like, Varals is a threat on his own, So it's kind of one of those situations where it gives you protection against like surgical extraction effects or cranial extraction, things like that. So like, whereas this deck is, it's one of those decks where yes, you can win with the beatdown plan, but if your opponent just has a surgical extraction and can extract your kitchen fix when you go to combo them off, you're SOL if you're playing a straight up stock list. And whereas you're playing here, and in the past you've actually seen it, the white black cleric from Return to Ravnica was used instead of Barrels to Star Strike.
Scene Collector?
No, Cartel Aristocrat.
Cartel Aristocrat, yeah, and it's the same situation. You're just, I think I like Cartel Aristocrat better, to be honest, but I think they do the exact same thing. It's just a way to get redundancy and not have all of your sacrifice outlets be the same card.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, it's a pretty cool deck.
Yeah, and when you, like, combo off with Anafenza, and if you have Cartel Aristocrat, you can basically make your Cartel Aristocrat pro anything, and then, like, with Anafenza triggers, you can get to a point where you can, I'm pretty sure you can put the counters on the Cartel Aristocrat and just keep going until you can make infinite counters. And then you just swing and kill them. And it's got pro everything so they can't block.
Yeah, there's some cool tricks. I'm kind of back and forth on this list. Like, I see, it's another one of those decks like we were talking about with Rally in Standard. It's one of those decks that's super, super good when you know how to pilot it and you're smooth and you know what your cord targets are and when to cord and how interactions with other decks work. But if you just pick up this deck, even if you are just good at Magic, if you just pick up this deck and try and run with it, it's probably going to bite you a couple times before you really, really figure out how to pilot it smoothly. So it's not an easy deck. Like, if even just looking at the list, you're like, I have no idea what's going on.
Yeah.
All right. I mean, like I said, it looks pretty interesting. I am not a fan, personally, of combo decks because they make me salty. Okay, so this fourth place list, then, I'm going to admit my total noobishness to Modern. Somebody's going to have to explain this.
It's a weird list.
It's Abzan Blink, and I have never heard of this in my life.
So it looks to me like a three-color mashup of Hate Bears and Coco. Like, that's basically what it looks like to me. There's nothing super insane about it. All your creatures have end of the battlefield effects. You're using Flicker Wisp and Cloud Shift to get extra value out of them.
Wasteland Strangler.
Yeah, it's real good. the spicies in this deck, as Washburn would say, the spicy meatballs. like Fiend Hunter, obviously it's not as good as Oblivion Ring, but Tide Hollow Sculler, you can get two cards with it, and one of them goes away permanently. Fiend Hunter's the same way. You, for those of you who don't know, you play a Tide Hollow Sculler or a Fiend Hunter, and when they come into play, they trigger, and you use the targeted ability from the trigger. So Fiend Hunter targets a creature in play, Tide Hollow Sculler targets a card in your opponent's hand, and then you blink it with that trigger on the stack, and then you get another trigger when it comes back into play. So you can use it with, like, Aether Vial on three. You play the card, cheat in a Flicker Wisp. You can use Cloud Shift, obviously, to do the same thing at instant speed. But it's so backbreaking when you essentially use one card. So, like, Flicker Wisping a Tide Hollow Sculler with Aether Vial. So you take two cards out of your opponent's hand, pay two mana, and put two creatures into play for a total of five power. That's just, I mean, it's so much value. Like, people don't look at it that way, but it's insane value. And
that is insane.
To be honest, this deck is just a beatdown deck on the surface. That's all it is.
Huh. Interesting.
Yeah. Yep. It's a cool little list. I think this is the list that, like, obviously it doesn't have any insanely expensive cards in it. It's obviously got the land base and it's got Noble Hierarchs in it. But outside of that, the deck really is not very expensive at all. And you could pick this up and be able to pilot it fairly well after just a couple times playing it.
Cool.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a sweet deck. I'm surprised it got fourth place, but
yeah, that's fair, I think. Okay, so fifth place, Lantern Control.
Good old Ensnaring Bridge.
Yeah, okay, so I don't want to go too far into the list because we're kind of going long. But what, Mike, what's your take on Lantern control in general?
So as a control player, I will respect anyone who took the time. Like, the guy, I can't remember his name, but the guy who's been playing this for like a year now and has gone, taken it to GPs and GP after GP, and then finally won that last one. I have nothing but respect for the guy, but these are the type of decks that make people not want to play Modern. Like, it's just flat out the truth. When you reach that point in the game, like for the pilot, when you're going to reach a point in the game where your opponent just can't do anything, but because you're not doing anything, your opponent thinks that they might reach a point where they can. So they just keep on playing and keep on playing, not realizing they're already dead and just won't admit it. And it's just not fun magic. Like, you can argue that combo decks are unfun, but you have to interact with combo decks. You can argue that control decks are unfun, but there are ways to beat control decks. This deck, once it has established its lock, there's just no way to beat it. Just period. There's no way to beat it. Yeah. You won't have any cards in hand. They'll be milling all of the cards you want to draw, and there's just no way to beat it. I think it's a good deck. I just don't think it's good.
So what was it that made this deck finally be good enough to win? Was it just that one guy trying hard enough? Or was there some card that came out that just changed it?
I don't think anything in particular. I think him just finally having a good finish with it was a big thing. Also, when he had that big finish, Burn was at an all-time low for the Modern format. So, but Burn is so good against this deck. Like, Sun Droplet is basically your best card, and sometimes Sun Droplet just doesn't do anything. So, it's a weird deck. It's a very weird deck. A lot of people probably don't remember prison-style decks, but this harkens back to a bad place in Magic's history.
Justin, do you have your speakers on?
Yes, I do.
I'm getting mic feedback. Not that I'm complaining. As much mic as I can get, if you know what I mean.
Oh, God.
All right. So let's finish up Modern so we can move on. 6 was Burn, 7 was Jund, 8 was Twin. Whoop-de-doo!
I take it you don't like Twin decks?
Well, I mean, I don't mind Twin as much as I mind less tier 1 combos that I don't understand how they work and don't know how to beat.
Fair enough. I can get behind that argument. It's not... The thing that bugs me is when people complain about decks like Splinter Twin when, like... And I'm gonna not name names, but a player at our store the other day was complaining about how Splinter Twin should be banned because, and I quote, it's just turn 3, put a dude into play, turn 4, kill you. And I looked at him and I was like, you really don't think that's how it works, right? And he's like, well, if I don't have a removal spell, then I die. And I was like, I can name like 30 decks where that's the case. Like, you put 12 creatures into play on turn 1 and then put a cranial plating into play on turn 2 and kill me. Like, it's the same situation. I have to have a removal spell. It's just not for a creature. So I respect you for saying that you don't hate it because of the cards in it and it's a skill-less win condition. But that's I'm off my pedestal now. That's just one of my big pet peeves is when people complain about the way decks work without actually knowing how the deck works. Most twin players won't kill you with the twin combo after game one.
Exactly. And here's the thing. Like, my thing about just Modern or most formats in general is I don't like the idea of infinite combo. That's just unfun to me of, you know, no matter what it is, it can be twin, you know, it's not technically infinite, but like ad nauseum or once that combo point is reached and I can no longer interact. I just don't have as much fun with that. And I'm not going to say ban it, it's stupid, get rid of it, but...
Absolutely. And that's almost my argument. And again, I don't have a problem with the deck, but that's my same argument with Lantern Control, is the deck just reaches a point. Like, it wins by making magic unfun for other people. And that's not, like, that's the game plan. Like, Splinter Twin, sometimes it's like, oh, well, you beat me and that's not cool. But there are also games where it's just a pseudo-control deck against your beatdown deck, and sometimes you just crush me before I draw the right cards. I don't like it when magic devolves to that point. Or rather, when a game plan puts magic at that point.
Yep, agreed. Okay, so... That's Modern for last weekend. Also last weekend, there was a TCG player 50K big championship tournament. I don't think I'm going to spend too much time on this event in general, just because a lot of it seems like the same old from standard. We've got one, two, three,
four
color rally decks in the top eight. And they only gave us the top 16 lists anyway. But I did want to note that there were two blue-green ramp decks. Both very different, just in general, in the top six. One ramping into Ulamogs, Whisperwood Elementals, and Ugins, and doing probably stupid things. And Drowner of Hope. I didn't think that card was there.
Oh, that card is so good.
I understand that it's good in, like, draft.
Oh, yeah. That's it's a bomb in draft.
But I just never thought I'd see that in a standard deck, and... You know, yeah, people complain the Eldrazi don't see enough standard play. Let's be real.
Now, Ugin sees a lot of play.
Yeah. And then, okay, so then Aliantrazi, a little lower in the standings, was pretty much playing extra turn.
Yep. He's not playing the white in the deck for the, what is it, Planar Outburst? Is that what the board wipe's called right now?
Yes.
Awaken. He's not playing white for that. He's just playing a straight up two color version of it. But at the same time, he's got it's literally like kill me by turn six or just never kill me.
Yeah.
Because Winds of Chalcisma says, oh well, you're not dealing me combat damage. And what is it? Mrs. Renewal, right? Is the card that says search for three lands and gain a bunch of life. Because once I do that twice, you're
chain seven life.
Yeah, I'm going to gain 14 life, and now I'm going to take mid turns. Or four of them, at least.
There's also a Mardu list I like.
Mardu midrange. Piloted by none other than Seth Manfield.
Oh, no. Above that, Wesley C. I didn't look at Manfield.
I'm not a huge fan of Manfield's list. That's the one I was looking at there.
Pia and Karen Noir. And
all day, every day.
Yeah, this is it appears to be a, like... Black red midrange splashing for Secret of the Way. Well, and Crackling Doom, obviously. But.
Yeah. Did pretty well. I think it's something I would attempt.
It looks like a solid deck. It looks really solid. The two copies of Nyxalis Reignited is ambitious.
I think you're right on that, yeah.
But if it resolves and doesn't die, which is probably why there's more than one, it's just insane.
Yeah.
Drawing a card. I played a game against Carson the other day where he resolved an Omnixilus, killed a dude, and I couldn't kill it. And there's no way you beat that.
Carson? I slow that dude $30. I'll get around to that. Omnixilus is a card that, you know, he's seeing play, but I still feel like he's underappreciated. I don't know if that makes sense.
You know, I think... And again, this is speculation, but what I'm hoping is that we see a lot more, and it pains me to say these words, we see a lot more threats that are more diverse than Siege Rhino, Anafenza, Mantis Rider, Soulfire Grandmaster in Oath of the Gatewatch, because that will allow us to look at other cards and see whether they're better or worse than the removal and planeswalkers and whatnot we're playing right now. Right now, there's just no reason, like we talked about earlier, you just play the best spells. There's no reason to go from what we're playing and what's on the fringe to the stuff that's way, way in the bottom of the box. There's just no reason to do that.
Yeah, absolutely. There wasn't any, other than the, you know, couple odd Mardu lists, I didn't really see anything stuck out as, you know, completely new or innovative. I think what it does illustrate, though, is that right now, Standard is at a place where, I mean, obviously not 100%, but if you're a good enough player, you can probably get away with pretty much anything.
Yeah, pick the deck that you enjoy the most and know the best, and like it's a Patrick Chapin kind of mentality. You don't play a 60, you play a 75. If you have a deck that you know inside and out and are a good, solid pilot with, move cards around. Like, find your worst matchup or what the most popular matchup is in your area and just sideboard or mainboard cards for that matchup. It's not actually a bad thing to do that. Like, I make jokes every time I see Gordon about how he beat me game one during Pharaoh Standard with a Pithing Needle naming Mutavol. Like, it just happens. He metagamed for a tournament and he won the tournament. Like, there's, I can't be mad about that. He prepared better than I did. So don't let anyone tell you that by playing hate cards in your main board for decks that are popular, you're a bad person.
Yeah, definitely. Well, and I think that, you know, one, especially in our area, I think, you know, the budget standard decks that, you know, people like MTG Goldfish put out, or, you know, some of the more budget conscious, good Magic players are putting out, they're still good. Like, if you're a competent player, those budget lists can still, you know, pull one over on the tier one deck. You don't need four Jaces to play standard, right?
Oh, absolutely.
You don't.
Absolutely.
You kind of need fetches because they're really good. Like, you don't need them, but they're really nice to have.
We had this conversation briefly while we were in Kansas City, and I've had it many times with many people. But if you are a Magic player and you want to be competitive and you played during Cons of Tarkir standard, there's no excuse. Like, yep. Some people I understand didn't have the money to buy them then, and that's fine. I will not tell you that you're wrong for not spending money on them because you have better priorities than I do. However, when 5 months ago, all of those fetches were under $15, and now they're all over $20, and your complaint is, well, I didn't have a chance to get them, that is not an actual complaint.
Yeah.
You should have manned up and bought them if you thought you were going to need them. I get that maybe they were too expensive, but
yeah, pretty much.
Don't then say, "Oh, I didn't have a chance." Well, you had a chance, but you chose not to, which is fine. Let me clarify that. It's fine, but don't use the excuse that you didn't have a chance because you most definitely.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was around Fate or Forge when they really like were at their lowest. Maybe Dragons, but yeah, they were. I mean, they were just pick them up for dirt cheap. That's when I got my Polluted Deltas and Flooded Strands.
I had extras of all of them, and when I went to GP Oklahoma City, there was a vendor offering $27 for Polluted Deltas, and I'm like, I have three extras. Am I going to need more than four? Probably never. Okay. I'll make $90. It was just insane. And then the guy also offered me $10 for Eidolon of the Great Revels. I'm like, take them. I'm never going to play this card.
Yeah.
He's making like a dollar profit on each of those. That's ridiculous.
Yep.
Yeah,
right now.
They were pretty insane, what price they were given.
3 months from now, he's going to be selling those fetch. Well, not 3 months from now, like 6 months from now. But he's going to be selling those Polluted Deltas for $60.
That's fair. Okay, so one thing I wanted to talk about with this episode, first of all, I wanted to let you guys know, I think the title for this episode is Spicy Meatballs. I wanted to talk about, building and maintaining and being part of a local Magic community. Now that we have all the deck lists out of the way, I mean, this is one of the main reasons I wanted to invite Mike onto the show. Is because I think he's got quite a bit of first-hand experience with the Magic community, what with, you know, being a pillar of it in our area and all. So, Mike, why don't you give us kind of a brief narrative of the Grand Island Magic scene and, you know, your familiarity?
Well, so I've been kind of spoiled in my Magic career. Not in so much as that I've done well and been around fantastically good Magic players or anything like that. I've been around some very good Magic players and still am. But I've been spoiled because I always had a place to play. Like, it just so happened that during the times when I was in town and I played Magic, there was a place to play. Hot cards and comics. Hot corner cards and comics when I was growing up was a place here in town, and I used to hang out there for 5 hours a day. My mom worked late every night, and we would go there after school and we'd just sit there from 4 to 9 until the guy closed the shop and kicked us out. Super nice guy. He still lives in the area, still supports the trading card, whether it be sports or otherwise. But I left, and Hot Corner closed down. So while I wasn't playing, there was no place in town to play. They played at Hobby Town for a little while, had a falling out with Ed. Then Gary opened his card shop, and a bunch of the guys that I play Magic with now had talked to Gary about carrying Magic, and he wasn't too keen on the idea. And again, this is all before I came back to town, so I don't want to take too much credit with the building, but I definitely have helped since then. But Gary said, you know what, it's up to you guys. If you can grow the group and essentially turn it into something that can make money for the store, which is a totally reasonable argument, I will help support you with that. And so about this time, I moved back to town and started playing with some guys, Nate Labrie, Taylor Kluska, Josh Harry, and John Harder. Those were the four biggest ones. Shortly thereafter, I met Alex Rainforth and a couple guys that don't play at the store anymore, but there were probably about seven or eight of us. And for almost a year, that was it. It was just those eight people. We had a couple people show up once in a while, and it was tough going. It really was. But we loved to play Magic. And I think that's one of the biggest things. Like, if you are playing Magic to be good at it and make money, you're in it for the wrong reasons. And that is never going to help you. The two biggest reasons I've ever seen or been involved with that will help build a Magic community, whether it be hyper-competitive or otherwise, is you want to get better at the game. Like, that's number one. If you want to get better at the game and you enjoy the game, you're going to find other people who will also help you improve, people who are on your skill level or who are better than you. And the group of you, what amounts to like a playtest group, will help you build a community of players, whether they're brand new or not, that kind of help build you up. And I think that's where we started. I got really into Magic after we moved back. Or after I moved back, and we only had those eight people, and we were all fairly good, but we weren't getting any better. The same people were winning, we were playing the same decks, we were never learning anything new. And a couple guys from Hastings, Justin Washburn chiefly among them, since he's the one that still plays, started coming down to our store. They had played a bunch of like kitchen table Magic and wanted to start playing other stuff. And instead of seeing them as filthy noobs or noob razors or whatever you want to call them, we took those guys and helped them become better players. And that in turn caused them to want to bring their people into the group and help them become bigger players. And it just kept happening. I know that doesn't sound like a blueprint for success, but every person that joined the group for the longest time just kept bringing more people. Everybody would bring another person. And we ended up with a group of 30 to 40 guys and girls, to be completely honest, that just all wanted to play Magic and have fun and get better. So, like, a lot of the credit goes to those guys and not me. Now, yes, I definitely gave a lot of my time to be at the shop without getting paid at that time, I might add, to run events and run pre-releases and stuff like that. But that, to me, is the best way to build a Magic group, is just to find a community of people, however big or small, and start slowly adding people to it. And eventually, they'll just come on their own volition. You won't have to do anything. It really is as simple as that. Now, once you reach that point, you have to kind of figure out where you're going and what you want to do to keep those players there. But, I mean, it really is as simple as that. Cultivate a friendly environment. And then put a period at the end of that sentence. And that is the best way to create a good group. It really is. It takes time and it takes effort from everyone. But that's, honest to God, if I had to state the best way, that would be it.
Very nice. So, I mean, what, obviously creating this environment where people can come in and learn from the, you know, the card shop's perspective, what do you think is the key, you know, as far as that balance between making money and, you know, having a good environment for that kind of stuff? That's what I've always wanted to know.
No, that's a very, very good question. I think, I think it's different from different people's perspective. Like, if I were to open my own shop, for instance, it would be easier for me to say, I'm opening this shop for card players specifically, for gamers, for comic book readers and stuff like that. And I'm more likely to be, I don't want to say giving because that's not the right word, but I'm more likely to be open to suggestion about the way things should be run or the way we should do things or price support or price of tournaments and things like that from the community than I am if I'm, say, a a retail owner or a trading card shop like Gary is, for instance, because it's different than what my core values are, per se. So, like, Gary is, and this is not a bad thing by any means, because we've become a part of that family, but Gary's store is not, it's not a gaming store. Like, yes, we have that, and it is supported by him, and he loves us, and he will take care of us. But we had to grow it to that point. When we first started, Gary sold nothing but sports cards and collectibles. And that's his thing. I would never try and say he is wrong for wanting to make money off of something else that wants to use his space. Excuse me. But he's going to look at it differently than a card player is. He's going to look at it and see, okay, well, I can spend this much money and make this much money every time I buy a box or Xboxes or a case or whatever. Whereas a gamer mentality from running that situation, like myself, is going to see it as how can I generate more interest? Like, it's going to end up being the same thing, but we look at it from different perspectives. So I think it's hard to pinpoint what the reasoning is or how to balance the income versus attendance, I guess you would say. But it appears different from different point of views, I think is what I'm saying.
All right, and that's cool. And then the last couple months in our area, I think, have seen a decline in players, I think largely due to the sustained cost of the hobby. Now, I'm not going to go off and say, oh, prices of the hobby are too high, Wizards should reprint everything and lower the prices. No, it's not what I'm advocating. It's just that I think our Tri-City area, in general, tends to be lower income overall. It's not like we have, filthy rich white suburb kids coming in and playing Magic every weekend. It's working people who, work all kinds of jobs, and we have this, exactly. Still have a variety, but overall, generalizing the whole group tends to be lower income. So a lot of our paid tournaments and things like that I've noticed are of the lower attendance. But, unfortunately, I haven't been able to come up to Grand Island for FNM for a while, but almost...
That's a long drive, man.
Right. Almost all across the board, I think, in our area, FNMs are free to enter.
Yeah, and I don't know. We have definitely had, and like you mentioned, paid tournaments, it's definitely not just paid tournaments. We've had a severe downturn lately in attendance across the board. And while I do think some of it has to do with... The cost of the hobby, the way I look at it is the people who want to play are going to find a way to play. And maybe that's conceited of me because I'm one of those people, but the people who play kitchen table style Magic or play budget decks or don't have the most expensive decks in the format, those people are always at our tournaments. Doesn't matter whether they have the $2,000 deck or $40. They're always there. Now, yes, it's a free tournament and they're just playing with junk cards, but those people are always there. Whereas the so-called competitive players from our scene, a lot of them, and again, part of it is because of work or other time constraints. So I'm not bashing on them, but the more competitive players at our events tend to not want to show up. And I think it, at least in Grand Island, part of it is on me, and I will be 100% honest about that. Part of it is, I've been very bad at communicating. Actually, I don't want to say very bad. I've been worse than normal at communicating when we're having events and giving people more than like a week's heads up for our events and stuff like that. So part of that is me. When enough people don't show up to an event, so Sunday Magic, for instance, if 5 people show up at 1:30 to play Magic on Sunday 8 weeks in a row, 3 of those people who've been showing up aren't going to want to show up anymore because we're not having a tournament. They were there, they were faithful, and they tried, but eventually everybody reaches a breaking point. You're just not going to want to put in the effort in it. And the hard part is digging yourself out of that hole. And trust me, it is difficult. I'm working on it right now, and it's difficult. But we've still got a great group of players. I'm not going to complain about any of them. Some people are leaving the hobby because they're, quote-unquote, starting their real life and don't have the time or the extra funds necessary to keep playing. And you know what? Those people, I wish them all the happiness in the world, because at some point we all leave the game. We absolutely do. Now, some of us come back for whatever reason, but everybody leaves the game at some point. It's not something that you will do without fail for the rest of your life. It's just not going to happen. And it's a rocky road. And part of it, some of the things that don't help are retail stores carrying Magic now. And I know that's kind of a soapbox gripe, but retail stores carrying Magic is just, it kills stores like GI Card Shop, like Gary's store. Gary's gone out of his way to carry Magic for us for going on 6-7 years now, and actually longer than that, geez, almost 8 years.
It's because you're old, Mike.
I know, I'm almost 50.
He's not, by the way.
thank you. But, like, places like Walmart, for instance, carrying Magic packs and putting their shit out on shelves like 3 days before the game shops are allowed by Wizards, I might add, to put that product on the shelf. Commander 2015 was out at Walmart a week before we were allowed to put it on our shelves. But because of the amount of money that Sam Walton's stores give to Wizards, Wizards will never say a word to them. Not a single word. And it hurts. It hurts mom-and-pop stores like ours, places where we can actually play. And Walmart doesn't care about that kind of stuff. They just want to make money. So that, to me, is the biggest drawback right now. But I'm soapboxing right now, so.
That's all right. Justin, did you have any questions you wanted to go out since you've been pretty quiet?
Not questions, but, I mean, I left the game for, like, I was starting to get a little bit competitive, and then I quit for my entire senior year of high school because I wanted to really focus and do well and, like, just give my all for just one last school year. You know, I was like, I'm going to try this year. And after that was done, I was like, man, I miss playing Magic. And so I actually went to the Shopko Mall, and they weren't there anymore. I'm like, well, where'd it go? Like, there was a store here. And then I found out they were in the mall. And then, I mean, I'd been saving up so much money. I literally bought, like, 4 to 5 boxes of Magic from Gary that day. I'm like, yeah, I just need, just give me that. It's cool.
Just give me, well, like, every card here.
I need to get back in. And then Layton was like, pulled, like, singles out of the case. He's like, well, I was like, I used to play Green White Aggro, and he goes, oh, yeah, Fleece Mane Line. I'm like, ooh. And then they printed Seed Rhino, and my love of...
And so began the love affair.
And so began the love-hate relationship with your Seed Rhino.
Yeah, I remember my first time at GI Card Shop was on a New Player Tuesday day, and I had my, I don't even know what I was playing at that time, probably Rakdos, or Mono Black, but not like a good one. I played against Josh Harry, who was playing Infect.
Okay, yeah. Not a good time.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah, and I didn't get how Infect worked until I had already lost.
Yeah.
That was fun. I hate Infect.
You are far from the one, my friend.
Yeah, I know. It just makes me feel a lot better about it. So, yeah, I mean, I think that the numerous dynamics, so many nuances, the different angles you can look at a Magic community, and just the different expanses of Magic community there is anymore. You have your local community, and, you know, I think, I wonder, I don't actually know, Nebraska, I feel it might be pretty close to an exception, because I feel like we have a pretty tight-knit statewide community because of the MCG.
As a group as a whole, I think that's true.
Right, which is what I'm saying.
Yeah, I don't know. Don't get me wrong, I'm very close with a lot of the Lincoln and Omaha and Kearney guys, but I think as a whole, a lot of those guys are not very receptive to new players. Like, people like Eric Peters. Eric Peters is an awesome dude, and when newer players come into his store, he's super awesome about it. But I don't know that every store has a group like that.
And that's fair. I think that's fair. But I think that just as far as what I've been able to gather from, you know, people I know in other states and other Magic communities, it just doesn't have the same vibe. I think that how our stores are, you know, in different cities work together to give the players something to do.
Absolutely.
You know?
Absolutely.
And I'm sure it happens elsewhere, but I think that kind of gives this different sense to the Nebraska Magic community. I mean, I've seen it a little bit in Kansas too, but you know, I don't think it's to the same extent. But then, even from that, we expand to, you know, the online Magic community, which I think next week I'll probably rant about a little bit. and just the entirely different dynamic you can get from an online community versus, you know, the folks you're sitting around a table playing Magic with. And I just think it's awesome, and it's my favorite part of the game, personally. But
oh, absolutely, man.
I live out in the middle of nowhere, so what do I know?
I think part of the reason why our group is so, like, the overarching group, not our individual places to play, is so tight-knit. For example, I was on a phone call tonight with 7 other store owners, which I am not one of. I'm just the MCG representative for our store. But I was on the phone with six other store owners tonight, on a conference call, just talking about what we're going to do for the next year. And those guys are very, very passionate. And some of them have been in the game for a long, long time. Rick Paling has been playing Magic for, I don't want to say since day one, because he'd probably get mad that I'm dating him like that, but he's been playing Magic for a long time, and he helps run the store. He helps run Krypton in Omaha, and Hobby Town is the same way in Lincoln. They do a lot to grow our community as a whole in Nebraska, not just Lincoln. So I definitely agree with you. I think we are a very, very close-knit group. And part of that is because we have stores working together, whereas in, like, the Chicago area, you have Pastimes, which is just a company that runs stores. You have Legion Supplies that does the same thing. Like, there are, in all of the areas, whether it be the West Coast, the East Coast, the upstate New York area, New Jersey, Chicago, Denver, those places all have one store or one chain of stores that kind of controls everything. And it's still a group of people, but it's one overarching company. Whereas we are a bunch of people working together to just try and build our Magic community. So I think that's definitely a positive on our side.
I think we're a bunch of Magic communists.
It's definitely possible.
All right. Well, I think we have soaked up quite a bit of time. Luckily, I don't think we fucked up too much, so I won't have to edit too much.
Great. Ooh.
That is great for me. I don't know about the rest of y'all.
Congratulations.
So, Mike, did you have any final thoughts, last words, shout out, anything you wanted to give out before we call it a day?
I already gave my shout out to Nick, so I don't think I really have anything. I mean, obviously, thanks for having me on the cast. I've always wanted to do something like this, and it's nice to be able to do it with people I know really well too. So.
Aww.
Although yeah, he said he knows us really well, not that he likes it.
Oh, stop it.
Bing bong.
I slept with you guys in a hotel. Didn't
yeah,
happen.
You did. Bing bong. Washy, washy.
Washy, washy.
Bing bong, washy, washy. I'm going to have to edit that out, probably. But.
No. Leave it in. Or just title the podcast, Bing bong, washy, washy.
All right. Anyway, like, Mike, you may continue.
No, I... Nothing too fancy. I probably come off as arrogant to my friends because I know them very well and I feel like I can be more open with them, but that's not really me. I'm just a loud, obnoxious person. It's nice to just sit down and talk about stuff instead of arguing about things. I have more conversations about Magic that involve, no, you're wrong, and trying to explain that to somebody than, well, this is my side of the argument, and this is your side of the argument. Let's figure out why one of us is better than the other. So it's nice to just talk instead of arguing about something and never arriving to a conclusion.
Yeah, Mike, do you have a Twitter handle or anything people shoot you messages at?
You know what? I think I do. Hold on, I'll have to double check what the actual tag is. It's got me. It's got a picture of me looking really, really weird. I do stream though every once in a while. I haven't in quite a while, but
well, you'll have to send me links and stuff so I can put those in the show notes.
Okay, I'll definitely do that. My Twitter hashtag is @BorafilsMTG, capital B O R O F I L L Z M T G. I'm just a big kid playing Magic and streaming Hearthstone.
All right, and what's your Twitch channel?
It's just twitch.tv slash Borofills. B-O-R-O-F-I-L-L-Z.
Cool, cool. Justin, any shout-outs, last words, sign-off, anything?
I don't know what I'm going to do when Seedrunner rotates.
Okay, we've discussed this, Justin. You've got a couple months to worry about it, okay?
No. He said the same thing about Armada Worm.
Armada Worm? Dude, that card's good. I don't care if it's like a dollar mythic rare. That card is a bomb.
Yeah, I can't disagree with you.
Yeah, I mean, you're not wrong, but you need to move on.
Also, Avid of the Worm. Oh, so good.
This is going to start a whole other conversation that we don't have time for.
All right, so Justin is cut off. All right. Okay, well, as always, this show is brought to you by Dungeon Delver Gaming Supplies of Hastings, Nebraska. Check them out online, or if you're in the area. And you can follow me on Twitter at NerdMeat. I've always got my phone on me, so if you message me on Twitter, I will get it. And as always, thanks to everyone at the MTG Cast Network who hosts our podcast at no benefit to themselves. So if you frequent that website, if you listen to a lot of podcasts there, please, please, please sign up for a membership, help them out, make a donation, do something, give them something so they can, so they're not losing money on it. But they do it out of the kindness of their hearts. There's so many good podcasts. So, give them a look. With that, this was episode 16 of Midwest Magic, the only podcast where you can get on, Grandpa Mike Thompson's wonderful stories from back in the day. So,
yeah.
Back in the days of Alpha, boys, girls.
We will see you next week.
Spicy meatball.